This is ESPN 1000, WMVP, WSHE, HD2, Chicago, a Good Karma Brands radio station.
Now, back to more Waddle and Sylvie, live from the Old National Bank State Street Studio.
On Chicago's home for sports, ESPN 1000.
If you missed the Liam Hendricks interview, we're going to replay it at 5:30. Coming up here at 4:30, I'll play you a part of it, a soundbite when he explains about the meeting they had with Tony La Russa, the leadership council. If you didn't know about this, he clarified what it is, what the leadership committee is. And it was Tony who called it right after the Johnny Cueto incident. And it happened before the first Detroit game, and they've won every game since.
Manager of the year.
So it was a good move. We'll play some of it at 4:30, and we'll play the entire interview at 5:30. I think Liam Hendricks is as open and candid as any athlete in the city of Chicago. Wilbon is going to piss some people off at 5. Just wait for that.
Well, it is Wednesday.
Let's talk to Dan Durkin. Dan, if you've followed sports radio in this town, if you have followed him from his spots, and now he's got a great YouTube page where he breaks down the All 22 film from each and every game he played collegiately.
He really does watch film. Everyone on Twitter will tell you, I watched the film. Dan actually does watch the film.
And he translates it well in layman's terms that we could all understand. Yeah. We've talked to him for many years. This year we said, look, let's talk to Dan weekly. Let's get him in the fold. Let's talk to him every week about what he saw, what he liked, what he didn't like from Bears football, and let's all learn together. So Dan Durkin joining Waddle and Sylvie for his first of weekly hits here on the ESPN 1000 Waddle and Sylvie show. Hey, Dan.
Dan. Gentlemen, how are you?
Everything's good.
We're a little pissed, to be honest.
Why?
Well, because Sylvie and I both believe this was a wasted week for the Bears because the NFL scheduled a short week, you know, training camp preseason game when they could be practicing and doing different, more important things.
Interesting. Yeah. I want to get a clarification on your manager of the year comment before we talk Bears. Are you talking about Johnny Cueto? Just be sure that that's the manager.
Dan, that was just me being my normal wise-ass self, for sure.
I appreciated it very much.
Somebody called the post-game show last night, I believe, and did suggest that Tony deserved to be manager of the year. So.
Wow. Okay. I'm glad I missed that. I'm sorry that you guys feel upset about the way this is scheduled. I mean, personally, I think the more you can see them line up against players other than their teammates, it's a good thing. And so the more live reps these guys can get, the better. Definitely an up and down performance, I think, overall last week against the Chiefs. But a couple guys did stand out from my perspective. So I'm curious to hear what questions you guys have on your head.
Yeah, the first thing I would say, though, is look, what would have been ideal for me is for this team to fly to Seattle and work with the Seahawks for a couple of days and then play a game on Saturday or Sunday. I just think that it's, you know, for a young team that's trying to establish itself. And then what did we hear? They're only going to play 6 or 12 plays because they're working on a short week. I think the scheduling from the league for preseason was just really strange and weird.
Yeah, I mean, the Thursday games in the preseason is kind of bizarre. Other than, like, the Hall of Fame game, I'm with you. That is really strange. But, I mean, I agree. I'm wondering why joint practices aren't just more of, like, a normal thing for the league, especially when you're talking about these longer trips. Yes. As you're alluding to, it's not an easy flight to Seattle. You're crossing many time zones, so now you get into, like, the sports science and the circadian rhythm and all that type of stuff. So I hear you wholeheartedly on that. But when you look at this team and, like, when you really think about everything is future-facing. I mean, let's just be real. Like, everything about this team is, hey, we think we got our quarterback, but, like, what else? So you have, like, your pillar piece in the middle, but, like, who is going to be along for this journey? Because, I mean, this roster is going to look very different next year, and it's probably going to look different the year after that. And so, like, what I was most encouraged about from last weekend was I think that the big winner in this was Ryan Poles, guys. I'm not going to lie. When you're looking at what he was able to could procure in the draft in terms of guys that look like, you know, they're gonna make the team, but they're gonna be pretty significant contributors. Now, there's two ways to think about that. One would be the cynical view of like, well, the roster stinks so bad, of course these guys are gonna play because there was nobody else there. But then when you actually evaluate on a per play basis what these guys did, there were some glimpses, especially Jaquan Brisker. I thought he was fantastic. I think that you see some guys like, oh, they have some immediate day one starters, like legitimate NFL starters that they were able to get from this draft without a first round pick. So I think that in itself was a win.
Dan Durkin joining us. He'll join us every week during bear season. It's Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000. I saw on your YouTube page you broke down, I think, every snap from a few of the offensive linemen, including Braxton Jones. He's a late-round pick. What do you like from him, and what do you not like from him?
Good feet. So I'd say from a positive perspective, I think it's really good feet. What stood out to me, you know, like it was very evident, is they talk about the ability to mirror. And so how can you stand in front of somebody as the blocker, or like the literal shield between the defense and the quarterback, and mimic his movements without really overstepping and keeping balanced and knowing that you're going to get a jab step. You're either going to try and fool you with footwork, they're going to try and fool you with their hands, and to be able to mirror and mimic that. And then when you have to put your hands on them to redirect them, I thought that his footwork definitely stood out to me as like, oh, this guy has really good feet. Now, the negatives for me, there are two advantages the offense has on a run play. One, you know the snap count. And number two, you know where the play is going. I think he was laid off the ball in a couple runs. And I know, like, just in hearing offensive line coaches, that had to irritate Chris Morgan, like, significantly, to be like, you can't be the last guy off the snap, especially when the run is going your way. And that happened a couple times. So I think that those were good teachable moments for him. And the other part that I think in terms of development is he's got to get stronger both in his lower half and his upper half, because his punch, while it was accurate, his ability to get his hands on the defender was accurate, it wasn't very powerful. He got pushed back a couple times. So now you think lower body strength to be able to withhold that, but then also when you put your hands on them, set them back a little bit too. But the footwork part is so essential for good offensive line play, particularly on the left side. And then when you look at what the Chiefs did, they, like, Spags, like, he brought a cover zero right off the rip. So I mean, he came in and brought a blitz. They were showing a lot of pressure look, so I think that it was very good teach tape for the Bears, because they didn't play a vanilla defense at all. They threw a lot of pressures at these guys, and I think for the most part the protection was right in terms of they had enough people in. There were several breakdowns though in pass pro, which I think contributed to an up and down day also from Justin Fields.
When we look at Jones, Dan, and it's one game, so I know I'm asking this very, very early, and it's 3 weeks of practice. But is this guy going to be like another Charles Leno, where you can play him at left tackle for the next few years, but he's basically like a replacement level left tackle? Or do you have hope that he could finally solve the left tackle position that we've been needing here in Chicago for years?
I think it's still a to be determined on that. I think right now you have a replacement level player who has the potential to blossom into something more. You can teach him how to lift and eat like a professional athlete, and he's going to have different just, you know, resources that he didn't have, you know, at the collegiate level. So you should see some maturation from a physical standpoint from him. I do think right off the bat, to be able to get somebody that you would trust day one to come in, they kept him on an island. I thought that was good. They didn't bring a lot of help to his side. To see him be able to hold his own for the most part is encouraging. So I'd say still a little early to make that determination, but for me, the most important part when you talk about, you know, they want offensive linemen who are athletic, no, for two reasons. One, to be able to match speed on the outside. So can you stay with these guys? But with this zone running scheme that they want to do, these offensive tackles, and you saw it a couple times in the games, these guys are used as pullers. So the tight end will block down, and then these guys need to pull and get to the second level, or in some instances, the third level. Can you run fast enough out there to get in front of a linebacker and hook him? Can you run out there fast enough to get in front of a safety or a cornerback that's playing force and push him out of the way to create an alley? And he showed the ability to do that. So I think that was definitely the plus from his performance.
Dan, based on what you've seen from Tevin Jenkins on film, small sample size, obviously, does he project, in your opinion, as a guy that can handle the guard position? Is that what he's best suited for?
I think so, because when you look at, I mean, he's super physical. Like he once he gets his hands on a guy, he's got really, really strong. Like they talk about like a clamp, and they talk about like, you know, how strong his hands are. Once he gets his hand, Cody has really strong hands too. Once he gets his hands on a guy's pad, it's pretty much over. He has really strong grip strength. So, I mean, I was really encouraged with that. My concern with Tevin coming out, and I really, really liked him coming out of Oklahoma State, was didn't think he had the footwork to play left tackle. And I think you've already seen that he's not a left tackle. And then just like his arm length, his arms aren't very long. And so when you think about that, things happen quicker on the inside. And so short arms are less of a factor. It's like, can you get your hands on somebody quick enough to make sure you're thwarting a three technique that might be crossing your face or some guy that's looping behind you? So I think Tevin is probably going to settle in best on the inside. And that was speculation from a lot of offensive line experts coming out, is this guy might be better suited to kick inside. And so now when you think about the Bears, they need to find the best five up front. It's like whatever combination that comes out to be, you need to figure that out rather quickly. And so I do think his best pass to play is probably at guard for myriad reasons, but I really like his demeanor in the run game. I think that he really likes to bury guys, and I think he really takes pride on, you know, putting his guy on the ground. And so you need a little bit of that grit. You need a little bit of that nasty on the offensive line, because they've really severely lacked it over the last couple of years. And now when you talk about the type of zone scheme that they want to run, yeah, he ran that at Oklahoma State. He knows it well. So I think that really good match and a really good opportunity for him to step in and start. Did not like what I saw from Schofield at right guard. So I think that's a great opportunity for Jenkins to see the moments to become a starter.
Dan, my biggest criticism recently with the previous regime was as crazy as it sounds, it didn't make sense. Whether you were looking at the game plan, the route combos, protection asks, whatever it was, it just didn't make any sense to me. I know we're very early here, but based on what you've heard or seen from training camp and what you saw early in the first preseason game and just knowing Luke Getsy and where he's coming from, is it your anticipation that when you watch film, it's going to make more sense than it has in recent years?
You mean running your receivers past the third down marker on
all
third
of that
down,
basic like, stuff, yes.
things like that,
yes.
And you saw that. And yeah. So I think that was very encouraging to me, was just the basics. I think some of the concepts you saw were like, they're probably not showing a lot, but I did like the fact that they were stressing the defense in some ways. I love the switch release on the fade to Mooney up there. It's a trust.
They do that a lot in Green Bay.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, when you have two corners that are going to be pressed up like that, that's a perfect call for that situation, because, right, hey, if the defense wants to come up and press you like that, there's going to be four bodies in a very small area. So on a switched release, which basically means in that instance, Darnell Mooney started out as the number two, meaning he's the second receiver in from the sidelines, and he swaps with the one. So he actually runs the lane of the number one receiver, and then the number two comes inside. That number, the cornerback that was supposed to follow him there, he got completely picked, and that gave them enough time to make the throw, and it also kept the deep safety away from it. So like, that's just smart little design. You're scheming to get your best players open, and that's a route that him and Justin have probably thrown 1,000 times this offseason, 5,000 times this offseason. So why not put that one up there? So I think that making sure that you have certain plays in there that are purely based on, we like this matchup and we know Justin can throw this and see this here, that to me is smart coaching. You did see some, you know, past the third down marker, which I like. You saw it so many times last year where they were running the ball short of the sticks. I'm like, how is that okay? You know, set your team up to succeed. So smart things like that. And I like the amount of checkdowns that he's built into this. You saw more motion. So to me, it's definitely a more advanced in terms of who do we have, what do we want to do schematically, how are we going to be able to manufacture shots down the field, because A, this is a young quarterback that's still learning how to be a drop back passer, and B, our offensive line is probably not going to be able to hold up a lot to allow him to be just, you know, a 5 or 7 step guy that's sitting back there. So now when you run that outside zone, you're creating opportunities, you're changing the launch point, you're fooling the defense. Those are all the things that play to Justin's strength, and I remember talking to you guys about that for years. This to me is the right scheme for him.
Yeah, coaching means a lot, especially with a young team like this.
Especially
agreed
in football, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Dan Durkin joining us. It's Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000. Where do you have the ceiling on Mooney? Because we've all debated, can he be a one? And then someone was asking on Cap and Jay Hood today whether or not Mooney is the second best receiver now in the division, obviously Justin Jefferson being number one. Answer both of those.
Interesting. So Justin Jefferson is by far the best receiver in the division, so that's not even comparable. I do think he could become, you know, maybe like, you know, if you think about it in tiers, or if you're going to think about it like in thirds, I don't know if he'll be like an upper third. So you think about like maybe like the top 10, 12. I think he can sit somewhere in like the lower portion of that second tier. So when you think about guys like 13 to 20 something around there, 24-ish, yeah, I think he could be in that territory. Look, this guy is incredibly quick. I love the fact that he doesn't have wasted motion in his breaks. What I mean by that is, some guys will signal to you, hey, I'm about to break now. Watch my hands. It looks like I'm rowing a boat. Or, you know, there's different signals they can give to a cornerback. I think he's really smooth with his footwork and his hands to get in and out of breaks. And he is really quick, guys. I mean, he has a ton of speed. And so when you think about what are the right routes we want to put into play for him to do that, I think that he has a chance to really exceed. So when you talk about what's his ceiling, I don't know, a 1,300-yard season, you know, maybe double-digit touchdowns, I do not think that's out of the realm of possibility. Primarily because he's going to get volume. He's going to get a lot of targets his way, and I think he's going to be productive with them. And then when it comes to like receivers in the division, yeah, I'd say you could say he's probably in that team vote. Adam Thielen is still a pretty good receiver too. So you have to think about. I think Minnesota has a pretty excellent group. Very eager to see what the Packers look like now with Alan Lazard and what it looks like without Devontae Adams. But I definitely think he's in that team photo of a difference making wide receiver. Yeah, NFC North.
My immediate response to that question was, have we forgotten about Adam Thielen? And I understand he's going to be 32 years of age later this month, but he had 10 touchdown catches this past year, 14 the year before. He's averaged 10 touchdown catches a year for the last 4 years. When we went through my list of most important players, this is who I had hoped. I said if Darnell Mooney can become Adam Thielen in his third year in the league or someone in that, boy, that's a huge home run for this team if he can make that leap to somebody who can be a double-digit touchdown reception guy.
Completely agree. Now, what you have to worry about, though, is can they have somebody else command the attention of the defense to where they're not just going to constantly have safety help over the top to his side of the field? So now it really comes down to how do you use your tight ends? Where do you line your tight ends up in formations? Do you put them both on the same side of the field to now all of a sudden draw some safety attention there? So very eager to see where he lines up formationally along with like Cole Kmet and the different guys that they want to get out there. But I think there's going to be some opportunities for other receivers here because he will get so much of the attention. But I do trust Luke Getsy to try and get the ball into his hands at a minimum 10 to 12 times a game.
Dan, what can you tell us about Velus Jones from whatever film you've watched of him coming out of Tennessee?
Yeah, so really limited route tree. You know, he was basically running a lot of goes. He was, you know, a lot of in cuts, and so didn't really see the route maturation that you want. And then, you know, that's hard. You think about, I'm not doing this to like, you know, draw comparisons, but Kevin White ran a really limited route tree at West Virginia. Granted, he was great on those over routes and he was great on those go routes because he was super fast and he's a very violent open field runner. But, you know, when you get to the NFL, it becomes way more technical. And so now you have to wonder how quickly can he learn the nuances of, as you know, Tom, a very technical position to play at the professional level. How well can he adjust his routes based on unfolding coverage when he was really asked to run more of like an RPO scheme and like, you know, glance routes and things, or, you know, they're really basic routes over the middle of the field. But in terms of explosiveness, he has like legit speed. And so once you get the ball into that guy's hands, he is a threat to take the ball fairly far. So I think he's an immediate contributor within their RPO package. You think about, hey, if we're going to run RPO to the right, he's that guy you can come back to on like a quick slant or like a glance on the left-hand side. And now all of a sudden you've got a cheating linebacker coming in and you're popping the ball over his head and he could do something with it. You could see him on jet sweeps and stuff like that. So again, small package of plays for him, but super athletic and a true threat to take it to the house anytime the ball is in his hands. But you like to have that extra type of person on the team. And so I wish I could have seen a little bit of Byron Pringle because I did like a little bit with the Chiefs. But I think the Bears sneakily did add a lot of speed to their wide receiving core this offseason.
Dan, before we let you go, how would you like to see this Roquan Smith contract dispute get settled?
Quickly, I guess, is probably the guy's name. Maybe I'm the thinking about this obliquely, but I mean, he doesn't have any leverage. I mean, I just don't understand how he has leverage in this situation. he's on the fifth-year option, and that the Bears really wanted to play hardball, they could, you know, franchise tag him next year. So where's the leverage here? I understand he's a good player, but I really don't understand, you know, like what legs he has to stand on here. So it could be a bad signal to the locker room if you ship him off, because it's like, well, what are we doing with our best players when we're letting Roquan go? But at the same time, are the Bears really just a middle linebacker away from a Super Bowl? No. So if you can find a team that's willing to give up some picks, you know, for a team that is in a complete rebuild, I could see, you know, pulling the trigger on something like that. So I'd say if you are going to trade him, you better get a minimum like a first rounder and a couple like early picks as well to go along with that, because he is 24 years old. He is excellent. He's by far their best player. He's one of my favorite players to watch, you know, on a week in, week out basis. But when it comes to the return, it better be really worth it, because otherwise the signal that you could send to your locker room here could be a bad one. I'd like to see it resolved soon.
Is there a dollar figure you don't want to see the Bears exceed, like $18.5 million, $19 million per year? Where is the line?
I think that if you're getting past that, like, you kind of hit it right on the head. If you're getting into the $20 million figure for an off the ball linebacker, that's very problematic to me. So I mean, I think about like the 16 to 17.5 for maybe 4 years, somewhere around there. If he ended up with a deal for like $65 million over 4 seasons, something like that, I would totally get on board with something like that. But guys, when's the last time you've seen a team win the Super Bowl simply because they're middle linebacker? In this instance, a weak side linebacker. It's just hard to put your finger on that. And I know Devin White was fantastic for the Bucs a couple of years ago, but they won the Super Bowl because they could protect their quarterback and rush the passer.
And this is the rub, because he wants to be the highest paid off ball linebacker, and that would mean 5 years, $100 million. That's $20 million a year.
That's a no-go from my perspective.
Me too.
Good stuff, Dan. We can't wait to get into the football season with you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep. Take care, guys.
Dan Durkin. He'll join us each and every week. The guy studies. The guy breaks it all down. He played collegiately. He's a really good Little League coach, too, by the way. He's
nice.
Got Braxy's in his league, and he was tutoring him the other day. So as they move up now and do coach pitch.
It's fantastic.
Yes. All right. So we will find the gray, including a meeting that the White Sox had that Liam Hendricks told us first about. You will hear about this leadership meeting, and it has led to a great 5-game win streak.
Miss a show? All your faves ready and waiting on the ESPN Chicago app.
You are listening to Waddle and Sylvie on ESPN 1000. It's time to find the great on ESPN 1000, 100.3 HD2, and the ESPN Chicago app. Find the great, presented by Great Clips.
Sox are in focus here. 5-game win streaks are great.
Those come from behind wins late in those two games. That was great.
Those are great.
Those are great wins.
7 in a row at home. Great. Pulling within a game of the Guardians.
Great.
I mean, you'd like to be up by 5, considering where they've been, like 3.5, you know, 2.5.
I have a bet with Merkin that they won't win the division by 5 games. Merkin says they'll win by 5. I took the under because they have to get through 2 teams. Was that do you think that was a good play by me?
What's the total again?
The White Sox have to win the division by 5 games.
So if the White Sox win by 4, you win bet. I think you're good.
Like, and the reason I made the play was because not only do they have to get past Cleveland, they got to get past Minnesota. So you could be going on a nice little, you know, run, and Cleveland could be taking a dive, but Minnesota's up.
Sure.
And then when you go down, then, you know, Cleveland goes up. Like, you've got to get through 2 teams that are standing neither with you or in front of you.
Yes.
That's why I made the wager.
Yeah. I don't think it's a bad
ten
wager.
$10, big money.
You know how I have felt about this. I have 3 separate bets every time the White Sox got better odds to win the division.
What are they now?
Where are they right now? That's a good question. I bet you they are. They've got to be the favorite now, don't they, on DraftKings? They've got to be. Even though the Guardians are still ahead by a game.
Didn't you get one?
The Twins already won today, too.
Did you get one that's got really got nice odds for you, like plus one?
They were plus 135 or something like that. Like, remember, they started the year at, like, minus, what, 250 win the division? Yeah. Minus 300?
Yeah. All right, so you can still get plus money on the White Sox.
Really?
They're plus 115, but they are the favorite. They are plus 115, the Guardians plus 175, the Twins plus 230.
Wow, the Twins are plus
So what did the Twins come within now? Where are they?
They're half game back now.
They're half game behind who?
Behind Cleveland.
Okay, so...
It's confusing.
Well, I know, because the White Sox and Twins had been tied here the last couple of nights, so then they won today. So then there's the Liam Hendricks story. Another great thing. I love talking to Liam Hendricks. Like, this is, he's the type of guy that Waddle and I, for 15 years, have discussed having on the show.
Yes.
First of all, what's your number one rule for booking a guest on
the
show?
Willing contributor.
Right.
Like, willing participant.
Willing participant.
If you don't want to do the interview, just don't do it. No harm, no foul.
Like, if you're going to be on for whether it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 12 minutes, just be willing and be engaged. Like John Lester, when we used to put John on.
Willing participant.
John would be willing, and he'd tell you stuff, and he'd be engaged, and he'd want to banter with you. Theo was the same way.
Yeah, willing participant. If you're coming on the show and you have no interest in being on the show, and it's quite obvious that you're not interested in being on the show, do us all a favor.
Yes.
Just say no. We'll get you next time.
And Hendricks is not only a willing participant, but he doesn't, it's not coach speak. It's not cliches. He's going to tell you stuff. And the last time we had him on is when he talked about the Sox complacency, when he talked about needing to light a fire under their you-know-what.
He's a he's a willing and active participant.
That's what I'm saying. He called out Dallas Keuchel.
Yeah.
He tells you. And he's a really good player. He checks all the boxes. Yeah. And off the field, he's a very interesting guy. So we had Liam Hendricks on. I think he's closed out 18 straight for the White Sox now. Saves. Continues to be really good. He says he's been getting lucky lately, a matter of fact. So he'll even tell you, I've had 18 straight save conversions, but I'm not pitching great right now. So we talked to him about the Cueto comments, and it led to him telling us about this meeting that they had before the Tigers series. Take a listen to Hendricks.
Liam, how impactful was what Johnny Cueto had to say a couple of nights ago about the fire that he thought was necessary? Because it certainly seems like the last couple of nights that fire has existed.
Without a doubt, I think that there was rumbling throughout the clubhouse. I think Johnny said it perfectly, but we had a leadership meeting. I think the next day or the day after, and it was one of those ones that has coincided with the current streak that we're on right now. And it's, we kind of, not necessarily aired grievances, but we just, the players had said what I think, like there was probably eight or 10 guys in there, just had a meeting, and it was like, okay, what do we need to work on? And we settled a couple of things, and it wasn't anything drastic. It wasn't anything like world shattering or anything like that. It was, the group of us needed to make sure, it's like, look, we need to remain in the positive. We can't sit out there with the negatives of like, oh, well, that guy's not going to do it, so I have to kind of deal. It's like, okay, I'm going to go do it. If I don't, I have 100% faith in that guy behind me that he's going to pick me up and get it done. And that's the thing we had last year. That's the thing I think you're seeing this year. We're bringing guys into situations where they're just succeeding, where it's almost the expectation of like, hey, you're going to go out there, you're going to do this, and then we're going to win this game.
Liam, what is the difference between a team meeting and a leadership meeting?
Team meeting involves the entire team. Leadership tends to be just the veteran guys who theoretically are looked up to by some of the younger guys. And it was that kind of role of like the guys who have been around a lot, you need to lead by example. You need to do the right thing so that everyone follows in that example. And that was mainly what it was about. But it was a very cool, like, I didn't get it out of hand by any means or anything like that. It was actually the first time I got to see the second half of the gym, which is interesting because there's a bunch of weights over there. But it was a really good and productive meeting. I think everyone had left that being like, okay, now, look, this is what we need to do. And it's been able to show on the field with the leadership that these guys have.
Is that a players-only thing, or does someone in management or the manager say, hey, guys, I think it's a good time to meet?
No, this is a Tony Run thing. He was the only coach in there. It was just Tony and a few of the players. And it was something that signaled that, like, look, this is our crunch time. This is what we need to do. And what do you guys think we need to do? And it's a collective input of knowing that this is what we think we need to handle. And let's make sure that everyone is on board with doing the same thing rather than everyone pulling in different directions.
We'll play the entire interview at about 5:30. It's also available on the ESPN Chicago app.
Good to hear that Tony, you know, felt like there was a sense of urgency that they needed to have a meeting and talk some things out. Sometimes it's you do want a collaborative environment. But sometimes it's important to have the guy in charge, the manager, be very assertive and not just ask questions, but tell guys what they need to be doing.
Well, but I also hope too. And he said, look, it was not necessarily grievances, right. But I would hope, as he said, Cueto was spot on. And what Cueto said did rumble throughout the clubhouse. It got guys' attention.
You heard Andrew Vaughn refer to that.
So maybe the veterans say, hey, Tony, you know, you don't agree with this or you don't think that Cueto should have said this. We think this is good for us. We think it's spot on. Maybe Liam Hendricks says that. Who do you believe are the 8 to 10 guys in there? That's what I was going to ask you.
I would obviously say to you that Abreu's there.
Right.
Tim Anderson's there, even though he's hurt. They probably bring Grandal in there because of his, you know, his experience.
Larry,
before he went on the
aisle. I know it. He's sitting
there. Larry is absolutely in that meeting.
Johnny Cueto is in there. Lance Lynn is in there. Maybe A.J. Pollock is in there.
Is Giolito in there?
Giolito's in there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Pollock, too.
Yeah, I think so. Pollock's
Josh Harrison for sure is in there, right?
Josh Harrison with a couple of hits last night. Listen, there have been some down Josh Harrison moments.
The last 3 months have been good.
Josh Harrison plays with the fire that you want to see these guys play with.
Revved the motorcycle after a single off the wall.
Listen, he's revving the motorcycle if he taps to the pitcher. We're just going to rev that motorcycle is what we're going to do. But you know what? The guy plays hard and brings energy.
Was it last night or 2 nights ago when he was thinking about going for two and he slid to stop himself?
It was last night. Listen, he made an error last night, too. Like when they tried to, the first pickoff move was brilliant. The second one they used was not, and it was an error on him. Like, he's not a perfect player.
No, of course not.
And he has made some mistakes, but the dude plays hard. He brings the fire to the game, and he has been a much better hitter over the last month and a half as well.
Yeah, so I think that's it's a very good thing. It's a great thing that it's resulted in 5 wins. I think he talked to after we had him on, it became a story. So all the beat writers went to, as soon as the clubhouse opened, went to Liam Hendricks, and I think he expanded even more. And he talked about, I think that they. Was something they discussed in there, or Abreu said, is that they got, instead of being confident, they were cocky.
Yeah. If you told me they were going to win these last two games without hitting a home run, I would have told you no.
Right.
Just because of the Astros and how they can score in offensively.
No home run, no TA, no Robert.
Yeah.
Not and bad to win these two games.
Listen, they've found ways late in games to get this done. Can you continue to do that? Like, there's only so far I think you can go when you're relying to coming from behind in the seventh or eighth inning. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, for you to get to where you want to be, like, there were moments in that game. There were two things. There were moments that they left on the table.
Sure.
And there were other moments that I thought that the Astros were about to put them away, and their bullpen rose to the occasion. If you would have told me Vince Velasquez was going to take the ball and get into trouble, I would have said absolutely. But then get himself out of trouble, I would have said no way.
Right. And then he mentioned in the interview with Hendricks, he talked about Jimmy Lambert.
Yeah.
They're raving about him on the broadcast.
He's had one bad outing against Kansas City.
It's incredible.
Over the last month and a half.
You never looked at Jimmy Lambert as a vital part of the bullpen or never thought he would get there. He's been that.
It's funny if you look at his numbers, too. He gave up, I think there was that one game against the Royals where he gave up 4 runs. But outside of that, I think you'd be shocked. Maybe you wouldn't if you're following it closely. But I think that if you looked at the statistics closely and you saw just how good he has been, just what the doctor ordered for them as well.
Can I give you another great, possibly?
Of course.
Do you know what's circulating with some Cubs fans? I know you haven't liked when I brought up the Cubs today. You didn't like when I brought up Bulls' schedule.
I don't like it. It's...
That people are starting to whisper into each other's Cubs fans' ear, is Franmil Reyes the Cubs version of Big Poppy? Did the Cubs just find themselves their Big Poppy?
I hope so for your sake.
Just like how Minnesota, didn't Minnesota DFA Big Poppy? and Boston picked him up. And
I thought Wisdom was going to be your Mike Schmidt.
You're right. The Red Sox signed him. He did some PEDs. that got buried in the papers, and then he just went out to have a Hall of Fame career. So is Fran Mill in line for that?
And why is Ortiz then, Big Poppy, Sammy had a bubbly personality.
Fabulous personality. He's everybody's friend. He's running around in the dugouts at the All-Star game.
We all know this, like you just said. I know you were saying. But why is he the exception? Why, A-Rod, you're not allowed. Palmeiro, you're not allowed. McGuire, Bonds, Clemens.
Because he's always got a...
Sammy, you're not allowed to even go back to Wrigley Field. Hey, Big Poppy!
Because he was part of the Mitchell report that was leaked and was never supposed to be identified. And so somehow he skates on that.
But that's the only thing Sammy was ever busted from.
But didn't he get caught in the Dominican with like a paper bag?
A paper bag, big deal.
But that was Manny Alexander.
With Manny.
Oh, okay, they were together.
It was a bag of money. Who doesn't walk around with a bag of money? They got casinos all over the
Meanwhile,
place.
Big Poppy's like, you know, MLB should have covered up Fernando Tatis Jr. testing positive.
But I know Sammy cheated. Of course, I'm not trying to run. They all cheated. We don't know who cheated and who didn't cheat. But it's a pick and choose on who gets in and who the bubbly guy is. Because he gave a good speech in Boston.
Pete get in?
Pete's not it. Pete can't.
The Hall of Fame. No. What do you mean what?
That's a no.
Pete can't get into a broadcast anymore after what happened a couple weeks ago. All right, that's fine. The great. So we have found that the Sox have learned how to win again, and the Cubs have found their Big Poppy. That's a good day for our Chicago baseball teams. I think we had someone on our show get a standing ovation at the Sox game. One of the four people in this studio got a standing ovation at last night's Sox game. Who was it? And find out why next.
ESPN 1000, Chicago's home for sports. You're listening to Waddle and Sylvie. Watch us and join the chat. Follow ESPN 1000 Chicago on twitch.tv or the Twitch app.
Tyler, were you dancing after you made the catch yesterday at the Sox game?
I was not, no. I caught it, did the classic hold it up, and then little turn, flip to the kid.
So Tyler Aki, one of our great producers here at ESPN 1000.
And the most athletic, obviously, as well.
He caught, what was it? How would you describe it? A pop-up?
So, no, it caught a ricochet. This was the weird part, too, because where I was sitting, you probably needed a righty-lefty matchup to get a foul ball that direction. But it was Cease and Jose Altuve. Altuve hits a foul ball a little off to, from Altuve's vantage point, off to the right. So a little up the first baseline. But it ricochets off, I think, what is our field mics at Guaranteed Rate Field. It ricochets off the TV and all those mics and the radio mics out there and then bounces back towards the left. It took a pretty big carom.
But it had to get over the net. So
I had to get over.
So I'm trying to picture this. So what does it come in as originally?
What do you mean? Like it?
So wait, does it hit something on the field and then go over the net?
No, it went over the net. Cleared the net easy.
Okay.
And then hits off of like the corner of the left side of the press box where all the TV and radio booths are.
Are you thinking you have a chance of catching this when it's hit or
no?
Not until it banks off of something.
No, once it banks off, I'm thinking, you know, could make a play on this.
Did you knock anybody down in pursuit?
Did not, no.
Where were you? Section what? Like 125?
133, I want to say.
133? Yeah.
So a little off to the left down the third base side from home plate.
Did you already have a plan in mind that if, in fact, tonight I catch a foul ball, I'm going to look for the closest youngster and present said youngster with that foul ball?
Every game that I go to, I pick out a kid beforehand.
Wow.
Yeah.
You do a little scout thing.
No, yeah. All my friends know that, too. They know I go in and I know which kid I'm picking out. Yeah.
Wow. It sounds creepy, but I get what you're saying.
that is a little...
I know. I mean...
What's a 25-year-old dude looking at all the young kids?
There's a golden heart in there. So what did the kid do when you handed him the foul ball?
I I flipped it across. It was like across the road. The kid had to make a catch too. All right.
Okay.
So I flipped it to the kid, and he caught it. He probably was like 8, 9 years old, I would say. But he was, so he like said thank you across the row, like when it happened. And then after the half inning was over,
his dad bought you a beer?
Well, him and his dad came up to me in the row and like said thank you again. And then his dad bought our, like my entire friend group. Beers.
Oh, wow. There you go.
The whole round.
This is a feel-good story. Yeah. This is really good.
You're a good kid.
So wait.
You're a good kid.
It bounces. So the ball bounces off like the press box area, and on a fly, you catch it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so you make the two-hand catch?
Two-handed grab. I don't think I could have done a one-handed because it was a little bit of a reach.
All right. So then everyone's clapping that you caught it, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then you do the
it was a little turn and flip. It was like a 6-4. Little turn and flip.
Wow.
Across
you
the row.
Spin, yeah. Yep. Little, you know, pirouette, and you delivered it.
Uh-huh.
So you got Johnny. You got a double standing ovation.
Yep.
Because
double
people
ovation.
Were happy with your catch. Mm-hmm. And then did you point to the kid
I pointed the kid with the ball in my hand. I did like the holding point.
Right here, I got flip. You. I've been scouting you.
Yep. Scouting you all game. Saw you when you walked in. And boom, flipped it across the row.
I probably freaked you out, creeped you out a little bit when you were over there, but I just want you to know this was all about getting you a foul ball.
Yep. And credit to the kid, he stayed for the entire game.
That's good.
It looked like he was a little heavy-eyed in the ninth, but...
Well, at least he wasn't puking like Carm's.
That's true,
Carmen took Gio's friend to the game who puked all over the concourse. Puked in Carmen's car.
It happens.
That dad owes Carmen a good upper-tier bottle of bourbon.
Yes.
Carmen was a mensch.
Carm's out at Whiskey University tonight.
It's Spears and Wheeling.
Sitting front row, learning how to hold his liquor.
It's always been, like, I think for most fans who attend a baseball game, most people have always wanted to catch a foul ball.
I'm one of those people, and I've never caught one.
Right.
Never close.
Well, you've caught an NFL pass, so that's pretty cool.
Different, but I would go to games, there were two issues. I wanted my Reds to win, and I wanted to catch a foul ball. Usually the Reds won, and I never caught a foul ball.
Yeah, I've gotten balls, but I've never... That sounds bad. I've never caught one.
Finish.
No, I'm not going to do it. Not going to do it. Wilbon's going to do it, and he may anger you. He has sent a warning to us that he may make Sox fans upset. So be ready for it. He's coming up next.